Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 182, Smorgasbord, April 2021. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I am Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, having fun. And today I'm bringing you a brand new smorgasbord episode. And in true smorgasbord fashion, I've got several items to share with you today. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to hear from my friend Liz Williams down at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, Louisiana. We're going to talk about a cool new program they've got going on down there, and which will be of interest to everybody in the United States because they've got a really cool program that they're looking for some local input on. After that, I'm going to share a couple of listener tips that have been sent in that'll be of interest to all you home cooks out there. We're going to talk a little bit also about fenugreek. If you listen to my most recent episode, Cooking Butter Chicken, where we did a live cook-through of that, I used fenugreek, and I didn't really have a chance to get into it in that episode, so I'm going to close the loop today. We're going to do a little bit of a deep dive into fenugreek, and then we're going to close everything out with another cookbook giveaway. So it's been about a month since I've gotten a new cookbook into a listener's hand. So we're going to do that at the end of the show. So make sure you stay tuned for that to find out how you can enter to get a brand new, free, awesome cookbook. But more details about that later. The show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/182. That's kitchencounterpodcast.com/182. For the show notes, I'll have everything in there that we talk about today. And I'll also in the show notes put timestamps for each segment so you know when they all begin. If you need to, if you come back and listen again, you want to jump to a certain segment, you could do that. Let's see, other housekeeping. Of course, you can always send me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Our Facebook group is Kitchen Counter Coffee Break, and you can easily find that by just going to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. You can find me on Twitter at TKC Podcast. You know all that, and it's going to be in the show notes too. I don't want to bore you to death with all that. So the show notes will have links to all that stuff. Well, we've got a lot of stuff to cover on the smorgasbord today, so let's jump right into it. All right, starting off today, I'm talking to Liz Williams out of New Orleans, Louisiana. She is the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and she's here to share a little bit of information on a program I mentioned a minute ago where she's looking for some regional input. And I know I have listeners in all corners of the country, and I know a lot of you are going to have some great ideas for what we're going to be talking about. I'm also going to put in the show notes a few pictures of when I was at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum back in June of 19. I know if you've listened to the show, you know my brother and I were down in New Orleans a couple of years ago. I think I did an episode on it, which I've been too terrified to go back and listen to because I have no idea what kind of state we were in when we recorded that episode. But we loved the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Really a cool place. Lots of home cooking love there. I'm going to share a few pictures of stuff that we had, that we saw while we were there, that I think you guys will get a kick out of. So I apologize in advance because I do gush a little bit about the museum at the beginning of this conversation, but I really do think it's a fantastic place. And anyway, I don't want to hold up the works too much here. So let's jump right into this with Liz Williams over at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And we're actually going to be talking about the National Culinary Heritage Register. All right. Well, Liz Williams, thank you so much for being on the Kitchen Counter Podcast.
I am very excited to be here.
I'm excited, too. You had an intern who emailed me and asking if I was interested in talking about the National Culinary Heritage Register. Of course, I am. But I'm also very interested just because you are an integral part of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. Yeah. And so before I gush on and on about it, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of who you are, how you're involved with the museum. I know you're a key person there, right? And we'll go from there.
Okay. So I am one of those people who has always been interested in food. Of course, I grew up in New Orleans, and you can't escape being interested in food if you're from New Orleans. But in addition to that, I also am half Sicilian, and I grew up in this large Sicilian community in New Orleans. And so that also gave me yet another underscore of being interested in food. So I just couldn't escape it. But I wasn't a person who could find, I mean, I'm, you know, getting into the elderly range. And when I was going to school, there was no way to study food except by going into home ec. And I wasn't really interested in that. So I wound up getting a degree in English and then, not knowing what to do, did what other people who don't know what to do is, and that is go to law school. And so I became a lawyer. Now I am a recovering lawyer. And at some point after a lot of doing this and that and the other thing, I decided to open a food museum. And so we opened in 2008 in New Orleans. And really, there's no better place to have a food museum. And we've been just growing ever since.
Listen, longtime listeners will know that my brother and I were in New Orleans in 2019, in June, I think it was. And we, one of our main, you know, points to hit while we were in the city was to go to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And we loved it. It was so much fun. I could go on and on about it. The two things, I got to tell you, the two things, actually, there's three things. I'll be quick, I promise.
Okay.
We'll get to the good stuff. The drinks on the wall, the history was amazing. Okay. You also, and I don't know if you still have it now, you had a display with like antique cooking implements.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, can you identify what these are? We stood there for probably 45 minutes just looking at these things. It was so cool because most of them were very, I mean, I had no idea what they were, right? They looked like medieval instruments.
Instruments of torture, right?
Perhaps. I'm sure some could be used that way. That was amazing. I still have a picture. You had a display, and I can't remember what state it was associated with because the museum, right, is set up
state by state
mm-hmm. right, in the southern states. You had a red beans and rice display where people, it was an interactive, and people could like write what their secret to red beans and rice was. You had a basic recipe, and then they posted on the wall. I thought that was so cool. What else? There was a gentleman there. I don't remember his name. I'm sorry. I'm like fanboying here because I just think it's so cool. He was one of your docents or volunteers, and he was an ex USDA meat inspector.
Right.
We had an amazing conversation about Boudin. I wish I would have had my recorder there. I'm like, dang, because Boudin was my new obsession on that trip. I couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah.
Quite honestly.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough about all that. Anyway, it's an amazing museum. People should go check it out if you're in New Orleans. It really is. New Orleans has a lot of really good museums, actually, not just SOFAB, but it's really packed. Yeah. But you're here to talk about the National Culinary Heritage Register, which I think is a newish program.
It's a newish and very newish thing that we've started. One of the things that got us motivated to do this was that the National Register of Historic Places, which is a federal register, doesn't really care about food. Now, if you can give some historical reason why something is important, or if you can give an architectural or aesthetic reason why something is important, and it happens to be related to food, then you can put it on the National Register, the federal register. But just because it's related to food is not a reason to put it on the register. So we said, well, actually call the National Park Service and talk to them about it. And they said, look, we're just not going to do it. We don't have a congressional mandate to do it. You know, they're government, so they needed that. And so they said, why don't you do it? And we thought, well, yeah, why don't we do it? So that's what we did. We started it. And so now we have to let people know about it so that they can basically self-identify. Now you can nominate somebody else that but you don't have to wait for someone to nominate you. You can say, I want to be on that register. And I'm going to tell you how you can do that, what it's about or whatever. But I also want to tell you why we think it's important. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you may know about some big company and the company might be more than 50 years old and everybody knows about it. And so you can always factor it in historically and all that sort of thing. But there are all these little regional places and hyper-local places that are very important in their community that nobody knows about. And they've been there forever. Everyone who lives there knows about them. But if you aren't living there, you don't know about it. And often they're not tourist places, so they're not listed in tourist brochures or anything like that. But they are very important. As we were talking about Boudin, they might sell Boudin and have been selling Boudin forever. But it's a gas station that sells Boudin, you know? They have been important in the community as an outlet for Boudin for people who travel or whatever. That's a kind of place that needs to be on the register. If it's a gas station, it doesn't matter. It could be a brewery. It could be a distillery that's really old. It could be a chocolate factory, a grocery store, a farm, it could be just almost anything, a fisheries place of some sort. And it could be a place that makes special pottery that's used to serve for serveware or something like that. Anything that has to do with food or drink and the table is what we're talking about. And so we think that if we can get people to self-identify, then all those little places that you might not be able to find unless you just happen on it, those places will be identified too. And then eventually we will have this huge database of 50-year-old and older places that have influenced the food of America. So that's why we are starting this. And it's just as important as the architectural historical thing that the federal government is doing, but it's about food. And food is always the last thing people think of, either because it's so ordinary, because we all eat it all the time, you know, and whatever reason, and we could politically talk about that for an hour for sure. We think this is really, really important. So being able to talk to people like you, where your listeners can learn about it, then they probably all have at least one place, if not many places, 50 years old or older, that they can nominate, that they can tell those people, you should put yourself on the register, because that's all it takes. We review it, but only to make sure that you really are 50 years old and you're not 49 years old. And if you're 49, we'll send you an email that says, apply next year, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not like we're trying to make it restrictive. We're trying to make it inclusive. Mm-hmm. And we want it to be everywhere.
Now, speaking of inclusive, I thought this was interesting because when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, we're probably focused in the southern region of the United States, but that's not true, right? This is a national register. So we're talking all 50 states.
All 50 states, territories. Yes. So District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, all of that sort of thing.
Virgin Islands.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So you envision that you might have, well, how many members do you have on the registry
now? We have about 120 right now.
And okay.
It should be thousands, you know, but we're just getting started. Yeah.
Yeah. I was perusing it and I might be wrong, but I didn't see anything from the Pacific Northwest. So it is my mission. I will find and nominate some place. I can think of a couple off the top of my head that I'll have to look into, but
okay.
Yeah, I love that I also love the criteria is relatively wide. Like you said, a gas station that sells Boudin and has been there forever and is an important part of that community could be eligible. I think that's very cool. If I am a listener and I say, I know just the place down the street, it's been there for 100 years and they should be on the register, what what would I do to get the ball rolling?
You want to talk to the people at that place and say, look, there's this register. I really think that you should be on it because you're an important place and we need to recognize you. And then they probably can say, this is our date when we opened, and, you know, give the information that we need that you can fill out on the form that's on our website.
Okay. And then what's the process after that? So you get a submission for, you know, Mary's Barbecue Pit. It's been in business for 75 years, and it's, you know, I don't know, it's the first place to serve Alabama barbecue in Louisiana. I don't know, I'm making something up. Right,
exactly.
They fill out, they submit the information, you look at it and say, yeah, this seems legit. Then what happens?
Well, so then when we put you on the register, then you're in the database, and then we have like a little badge that we send to whoever is the contact person at that place. And that badge can be used on their website to say that they're on the register. They could even use it in their advertising. They could use it on a label if they had a label because they were making something that was canned or bottled or jarred or something like that. So they would be able to do that. And then they get a certificate that they can hang up that says that they're on the register. So and then they're on the register forever. So that's really what's important. And we do ask them if they want to, if they're, for example, if they're a restaurant or whatever, to mail us a menu or something like that so we can keep it in the archive. And, you know, we make little bitty demands on them like that. But it's really nothing that I think is onerous. And if they don't do it, it doesn't make any difference. It's just so that we have something, because we do have a really growing archive that is growing in importance, and things like that become an adjunct to the archive, you know.
And I was looking at your list too, and the other thing that jumped out at me, and you alluded to this a second ago, but I'm seeing things like the Mary Barbecue Pit, the Mary's Barbecue Pits, but I'm also seeing things like KitchenAid and Lodge Cast Iron. So it really does run the gamut of what we would consider culturally significant to foodways in American history.
That's right. It's little and it's big. Not everything grows big, but everything started small. And so, you know, it's the sort of thing that is really, I think, important, because some things are only important locally, but they are important locally, and they've made their mark. And if you've made a bigger mark, well, that's fine, but we want everything. We want everything included.
So now I have a question, and maybe you don't want to answer this.
Okay.
But it almost feels like, is the Southern Food and Beverage Museum going to become the National Food and Beverage Museum at some point?
So we have thought about that, but the answer is that the museum itself is going to remain a regional museum. We encourage the founding of other museums. You know, are you familiar with the Museum of Food and Drink in New York?
I've never been. I mean, I've only heard, yeah.
But, you know, there are other places that have been established, the Brewseum in Chicago, places like that. So we're really hopeful and want to be, you know, a catalyst to other places opening up. And we think that if you've gone to a food museum in one place, you're going to say, I want to go someplace else. This was really fun. And it's a way to learn about the region where you are and all of that sort of thing. So definitely it's not competitive. It's definitely something that where rising tides, you know, float all boats. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. We want to encourage that. But on the other hand, the thing that we did see and that we have experienced is in those places where there is no food museum, people have written to us and said, what do we do with these artifacts? Nobody locally wants these things. What do we do with these menus? What do we do? So our umbrella organization is called the National Food and Beverage Foundation. So the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is a part of that. And one of its major components is this regional museum. But we also have as a part of our mission to preserve and curate other aspects of the American food scene. And so that's how we can have podcasts of people from everywhere on our podcast network. That's how we can have a national culinary heritage register. That's how we can have an archive and library that has books from everywhere.
So cool. I love that. I love it. And I'm glad that there's a piece now that people around the country can contribute to with this national register as well. It's just very cool. And I think you're doing pretty awesome work down there.
Thank you. So we're over 10 years old now. And that's the thing that I can hardly believe, because we opened in 2008, just really not long after Hurricane Katrina had hit the city. And so now, you know, in the beginning, I feel like we thought that we were making it up as we went along, you know, and now it's kind of taken on its own life. And so it's really kind of exciting. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, Liz, so if folks want to find out more about the register or the museum or the foundation, where would they go online to do that?
So if they go to southernfood.org, all of the anything that we've talked about, they'll be able to find there. And as we move out of the pandemic, we're going to be resuming our classes, in-person classes, and you'll be able to eat and drink at the museum again and all of that sort of thing. So it's really moving forward again and kind of returning to what used to be normal.
All right. Thank you, Liz, so much for coming on and sharing a little bit about the good work you're doing over there at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Again, the show notes, kitchencounterpodcast.com/182 to get to the information we talked about, including links to the register and the other cool stuff that SOFAB has going on. You can also go to southernfood.org to get right to their website. And you heard Liz mention, I think, at one point in that conversation about a podcast network. They have some great podcasts over there. You should definitely go check it out. There's a Louisiana Eats, which I listened to religiously before our trip in 2019 to New Orleans. A really, really great local food show. Liz has her own podcast on there, Tip of the Tongue. And then there's also a New Orleans drinks themed podcast on that network too. But anyway, put a pin in that because there might be more to say about that in the future. Okay, next topic. Let's jump over. I do want to share a little bit of feedback from a listener that I got that I think is interesting. And I thought this was a cool idea. And I just wanted to share this. So this came from Erica in Murrysville, Pennsylvania. So Erica, thanks for sending me a note. Okay, let's see. Erica starts out, hi, Roger and KCP staff, which I'm just going to pause right there. I find it incredibly charming because it is just me, actually. Literally me, myself, and I, chief cook and bottle washer, running the whole works here. I'm delighted, Erica, that it appears that there is, though, because I don't know. So a couple of tips that Erica sent in. One, she said, my husband and I really enjoy going to antique stores. See, there's already a tie-in with the history stuff. I love to plow through all the awkward lamps and flowery vases to find what I think are the real treasures, things for the kitchen. We find juicers, potato ricers, glass containers for leftovers and heating up, nut grinders, and of course, the best cast iron skillets and my personal favorite, delightful salt and pepper shakers. So the next time everybody is asking for advice on kitchen equipment, the local antique store may be another place to stop. Oh, yes, she says, and picnic baskets. So this is really good advice because I'll tell you what, quality kitchen gear will last forever if it's taken care of. And, you know, antique stores are usually a place to find good quality stuff because they don't sell broken down, beat up stuff necessarily, right? So this the comment about the cast iron skillets is spot on. You know, you can also often find good cast iron skillets at thrift stores. and resale stores and things like that. But Erica, yeah, this is a very good tip. You can find good stuff, even if it takes a little bit of restoration. Sometimes the restoration that is done will still get that product, that item back to as good or better shape than you can buy some new stuff these days. Then she had another tip, and I thought this was cool too, because we've talked about recipe management and things like that before. We've talked about apps and paper and pencil ways of doing things. But here's Erica says, I recently did something that changed the way I cook. For years, I've steered away from using recipes, mostly because I can cook just about anything without reference. But this got me into the habit of not trying new things. I had a Cook's Illustrated book that had very flimsy pages and was in a binder style. I decided to cut the recipes out that I enjoy for the week and put them into plastic sleeves and then post them on my refrigerator. This makes it easy to glance at the recipes and not have to go back and forth through the book. I also file them away by week to make things easy for the future. I don't know why this little thing helped me so much, but it has. I think it also has to do with not being distracted by too many recipes in front of me. I'm now also using photocopies of recipes from my favorite books. I think this is a great tip too, because I have a bookshelf full of cookbooks. I've got an incredibly messy cabinet full of just printed out recipes and stuff like that. Stuff I've clipped out of magazines that I've essentially just jammed in a cabinet door, and it's a disaster if I need to find anything. I know it's terrible for me to say, but I'm not a very organized person. So this idea of putting them into like the clear binder sleeves and then putting them in binders, or making them so you can just pop them up onto the fridge the week you're going to make them, I think is a pretty cool idea. So I think this is a great tip. And photocopying recipes from books, so you don't have to constantly try to find the book, the page, and keep it open while you're trying to make it. You can just pull out the photocopied recipe. Yeah, really good advice, Erica. So thanks for sharing those tips. Now, by the way, Erica also had a question, and I'm going to throw this out there because I didn't really have a good answer for this, but I know some of my listeners will. Erica asks, where do cooks go for help designing a kitchen? We're soon going to remodel, and we're not looking for showy or trendy. What kind of things should we include to make a really special place, space, for people who love to cook? Can you recommend some kind of guide or resource? I'm sorry if you've already addressed this in an episode. I have not actually addressed this in an episode before, so this is a great question. And I'll look forward to seeing if any other listeners have some good advice for this. And if they do, just send me an email, feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com, and I'll make sure to get it over to Erica, okay? Erica, in Murraysville, Pennsylvania, thanks for writing in and sharing those tips. All right, next item. So in episode 181, which was just the episode before this one, I did a Let's Cook episode where I live cooked butter chicken. And in that recipe, in that episode, I actually referenced one of the ingredients I was using, which was fenugreek. And I sort of glossed over what exactly it was. And that episode was going a little bit long, so I didn't really have time to get into it then. But I thought I really should circle back now and just do a little bit of a dive into fenugreek. So that's what we're going to do now. So we can close the loop on that spice that I know a lot of cooks in the United States, at least, don't really come across too often. So fenugreek, which is spelled F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K. So fenugreek can refer to both an herb or a seed, and the herb can either be fresh or dried. It actually all comes from the same plant. Now, when you're working with a recipe that calls for fenugreek, it should tell you what it's actually looking for, whether it's the herb or the spice. So don't worry too much on which one you need now. Again, when you get to a recipe that calls for it, it should tell you what you're after. The family to which fenugreek belongs is Fabaceae, which is the family of legumes, essentially. So this includes peanuts, chickpeas, peas, and other legumes. It's a very, very old cultivar. This has been a plant that has been in cultivation for thousands of years, for millennia. In fact, burnt fenugreek seeds have been found in archaeological sites in the Middle East dating as far back as 4000 BC. So for at least 6,000 years, we know fenugreek has been in use, or at least cultivated in the Middle East. Now, as I understand it, the English word fenugreek is actually a term that the Romans gave to the plant when they were in Greece trading for it. And fenugreek essentially means Greek hay, which is appropriate because if you smell dried fenugreek, at least it does have a very hay-like smell to it. We'll talk about that in a minute. Today, fenugreek is commonly cultivated around the Mediterranean, especially also on the Indian subcontinent, where you will find it. An important component for everything from spice blends like garam masala to curry seasonings to ingredients for stews and chutneys. By the way, the term in India for fenugreek is methi, which is spelled M-E-T-H-I. And I bring that up because, as we'll talk about in a moment, if you're looking to source this, you may find yourself in an Asian or an Indian market, and this is what you're going to want to look for. Of course, a clerk there will be able to help you find it. But if you're looking at packages, it's methi is what you're going to be looking for, most likely. All right, getting back to the culinary use of fenugreek. I mentioned that it's both used as an herb and a spice. Now, in the United States, at least, fenugreek in both the herb and the spice form can be pretty hard to find. Especially fresh fenugreek, which is very, very difficult to find in your typical grocery store or supermarket type situation. So if you're looking for the herb, if you're looking for the leaves of fenugreek, your best bet will probably be to find it dried. Now, this will be available at most Asian markets, especially Indian markets, as I mentioned. And in the episode last week, I even mentioned that's where I had to go find it. There's an Indian market just down the road from me. So I popped in there and they had both dried fenugreek leaves as well as the seeds. They had whole seeds and ground seeds. Now, with the dried fenugreek and the fenugreek seeds, the good news is if you don't have a market nearby where you can get it, like an Asian market, don't fret because you could get both the leaves and the seeds online very easily. Very easily. So I always like to refer to the Spice House, for example, as a great source of herbs and spices, but places like Penzies online and in probably your local spice specialty shop, if you have one of those, will probably have this as well. And once you have this, whether it's the leaves or the seeds, you're going to store them just like you would any dried herb or spice. So what does fenugreek taste like and how do you use it? Well, I mentioned earlier, it's not very common in the United States, especially in Western cuisines. So it's very likely that the average home cook has probably never run across this as far as an ingredient in their own kitchen. Let's start with the seeds first. So fenugreek seeds are these really tiny little sort of triangular pyramidal shaped seeds. They're very hard, but they have if you smell a group of them, they smell kind of spicy. Not piquant spicy, but sort of warm spicy in a way. When they're toasted, they'll give off kind of a burnt sugar maple syrup aroma. And this is interesting because fenugreek seeds are actually a very common component used to make imitation maple syrup flavor. So it does have a maple syrupy characteristic when it's toasted or roasted. I mentioned they're very hard, right? So if you're going to use fenugreek seeds, you either need to grind them into a powder, like a ground spice, or soak them for a period of time, or cook them in liquid to soften them up. Now, in the recipe I did in the butter chicken, you'll recall that I used whole fenugreek seeds, but after they cooked for about 40 minutes, it simmered in the pot with the liquids and the other ingredients, I tossed everything into a blender and then pureed them up. So they were processed in that way. But you want to make sure you're getting the seeds either softened up or ground or processed somehow, because the last thing you want is for someone to take a bite of your dish and bite into a hard little seed as they're trying to, enjoy your cooking, right? So they also require a little bit of a light hand because they can be a little bit bitter. They do have that maple syrup characteristic. So if you use too many of them in a recipe, you may end up getting something that's a little too maple syrupy or even a little bitter. Again, though, if you're following a recipe that's calling for the seeds, it should be giving you some sort of a quantity as a guideline to work off of. So it's unlikely you'll overdo it. Now, dried fenugreek leaves, on the other hand, are very aromatic. They really give off some character. And I was chuckling about this because I saw, when I was looking this up on the Spice House to make sure that they carried it, so I could link to it in last week's show notes, their description of fenugreek leaves. They say fenugreek leaves have the scent of a sun-dappled meadow. And you know what? They kind of do. I think that's actually a pretty good descriptor for fenugreek, dried fenugreek. They're kind of grassy. They have a sort of a sweet alfalfa type smell. Some even say that you can catch a hint of coconut in dried fenugreek leaves. And again, they are very aromatic. They can overpower a dish if you overdo them. But if you're improvising, it of course goes well with a variety of curries and things like that. But also spinach, peas, and potatoes are good flavor matches for dried fenugreek. So that was just a real quick rundown of what fenugreek is. I know, as I mentioned in the last episode, I didn't really get a chance to talk about it too much. I just wanted to close the loop and just give a little more background and information on what fenugreek was, in case you were wondering and were interested in using it or experimenting with it in your own cooking. All right, that brings me to the last segment today. We're going to do another cookbook giveaway. I'm going to tell you all about the book in a second, but I want to give you the exact instructions on how to enter so you don't miss out. This cookbook giveaway is going to be live until midnight on April 30th. That's Friday, April 30th, 2021. As long as you get your entry in before that time, you will be eligible for a drawing. Now, you do that by heading over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway. And you'll see instructions there down at the bottom of the giveaway window. It'll say log in to enter this giveaway. Use your email. You click on that. You follow the directions and submit, and then you will be entered. Now, the book I'm choosing to give away this round is actually just came out today, April 13th. It is Jeff Morrow's new book, Come On Over, 111 Fantastic Recipes for the Family That Cooks, Eats, and Laughs Together. Now, you might know Jeff from, probably, I'm guessing, if you do know Jeff Morrow from the Food Network. He is the Sandwich King. He's the winner of Food Network Star Season 7. He's also one of the co-hosts of Food Network's The Kitchen, really great show. And this is Jeff's first cookbook. And the reason I'm choosing this book is because actually on the next episode of The Kitchen Counter, I'm going to be talking to Jeff. He's going to swing by. We're going to talk about the book, of course, but we're also going to talk about some tips and ideas to help feed a crowd. You know, we're all sort of champing at the bit to get back together in groups and cook for people and have parties and things like that. And Jeff's new book, Come On Over, is it's a really a good cookbook. I've had it for about a week now. I've been reading through it. It's, first of all, it's very funny. If you know the kind of person Jeff is, he's a laugh riot. Really, I mean that. He's really funny. And it comes through in his stories, in his writing, in the tips and tricks he puts through the cookbook. But as I just mentioned, the subtitle, there's 111 recipes in here, all arranged by types of event, if you will. So he has hosting a birthday party, watching the game, throwing an island party, hosting the holidays. I'll tell you what, though. There's two chapters in here in particular that makes this cookbook worth the price of admission, and that is the firing up the pizza oven and chapter 10, which is, yes, I am still the Sandwich King. Some amazing looking pizza recipes in here. And of course, Jeff is known for his sandwiches, so he's going to have got you covered there. All right, so come on over, Jeff Morrow, kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway until April 30th. 2021 to enter. And then stay tuned for the next episode after this one. We'll have Jeff on and talk to him directly about all this good stuff. All right, everybody, I've been going on for a while, and I am at the end of my time for the smorgasbord episode. kitchencounterpodcast.com/182 for all of the show notes. for today's episode. Thanks so much to Liz Williams down at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum for stopping by and telling us about the Culinary Heritage Register. Great work going on. I'm hoping some of you can help spread the word to local food businesses in your area. Thanks to Erica in Murrysville, Pennsylvania for the food tips. And that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. I've got more stuff coming at you next week. I hope everyone is staying healthy and safe and getting to see their family and friends as much as it makes sense in today's day and age. So get in the kitchen and cook some good food, even if it's just for yourself. All right. Until next time, I am Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.